I'm a high-tech kind of guy.
I can tell. Well, thank you, Peter, and thank you to, and I thank you, Khalid. Really appreciated hearing from you. My name is Troy Jackson, and I am the director of AMIS here in Cincinnati. But I want to begin with a little bit of a personal story that's not always an easy one for me to share, but I think it's important to ground me in the space of the work and why it matters to me and my family. About a year and a half ago, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a piece for The Atlantic called The Case for Reparations, that looks at the American economy over the last 400 years as a systematic extraction of wealth from the African American community and from people of color, and goes through history of how that's happened, from slavery to the Jim Crow era, through redlining, and then even into the economic crisis of the 2000s. And our family happened to have a rental property in Mount Auburn that we purchased in 2001. We thought about actually moving into that property at some point, and it just never worked out, so we kept it as a rental property. And a young lady who attended our church and was on our staff at University Christian Church, where I pastored at the time, decided she wanted to rent it out. And so we got all the renters out, and she turned it into an amazing community house. And it was a community house for about 6 years. And over time, she had a baby and was married, and she also started having student debt pile up from her graduate degree and from her undergraduate degree, and they started piling up, and her ability to actually pay to rent the place as a community house and their ability to keep and hold that together with a family was dissipating. So we began to actually take a pretty significant loss every month on that property. And we're putting in $500 a month to keep it above board, because we pay our debts, we keep things going, we pay our mortgage payments. Well, we about 2.5 years ago, she said, "I've got to move out. I can't do it." And we're moving out in a month. And so we had some folks go in and look at it to see what are our options. Could we turn it in? We thought, we didn't want to manage a property. It had been turned from a multi-unit into like a single family home again. We thought, okay, let's bring a property management company in that can, even if we're taking a loss on it. And they said, you will have to put about $40,000 into this property to get it ready to rent again. And this is in Mount Auburn. And so that story in the case for reparations, we owed about four times what the property was worth already. We were not, there was no way we could have got that money. We couldn't have borrowed it if we wanted to borrow it and put more money, bad money after bad money at that point. And, you know, we were in a community where lots of families lost all their wealth that they had saved. The family home that was worth $100,000 in 2005 was worth $10,000 in 2008. And there were families who suddenly had gone from having some self-reliance and opportunity that were now caught in the payday loan structure. For us, what it meant is we were facing a potential foreclosure. And so my wife began to call the bank, and it was one of the major banks, and it could have been any of them, and see about a short sale. We looked at all sorts of options we could think, and she called multiple times and applied multiple times for a short sale with this particular multinational bank. Every time she called, they had no record of her previous conversation, until she got a letter just over 2 years ago in the mail that was suing us for the entire unpaid balance of that property. And my wife grew up very poor and on welfare as a child, very difficult childhood. And she is has a master's in social work and very proud and very stoic and had survived a lot and she kept that and tried to fix it for 2 weeks without telling me. And it's still kind of, I'm sitting, you know, sleepless nights because she was so embarrassed and so determined to fix it herself. And finally she sits down and lays out and talks about all the options she looked at. And there were two or three options, but the one that we ended up having to take was bankruptcy. I have a PhD, I am a middle class, white male, highly educated, good job, my wife has a good job. We got sucked in to a debt vortex. But the bankruptcy laws, I always say this, were made for people like us, like white folks who are middle class. And those safety nets are not there for people who are on the margins, who get caught in a current form of debt peonage, where they're in debt perpetually. So this is, and the one other thing I want to say about that is that I told one person outside of my wife, that who obviously we knew went through this together. I told one person in the first 6 months that we were declaring bankruptcy. That's because shame and guilt around debt and around what it means to be frankly white, to be an American, to be a male, all that stuff isolated me when I most needed community. That's what debt does, is it isolates us. It's one of the reasons I force myself, I'm debating, do I share this story or not? I said, I don't have time, do I? Then Peter said, I didn't tell him what all I was going to talk about exactly. He said, you got to take as much time as you want. So I thought, okay, I need to have the courage to share what is still a very humiliating story for me. And we're 2 years or a year and a half into this at this point, the bankruptcy. And so I just wanted to come clean on that, because I think one of the ways we overcome the power of debt is we start being real about what it's doing in our lives and families and our communities, and stop hiding it from each other. That's in our Christian tradition, real aspects of sin was hiding and shame and isolation. And so what I want to do this evening, and I am very mindful of the moment of silence that Imam Ishmael shared with us earlier today around the violence that's going on around the world. And I do think it's very much related to the lack of economic opportunity and the soul-searing economic system that we have exported around the world, and the desperation that's there that leads to tragedies and fear and violence and hate. I was so moved by, and I don't know if I fully understood this or what this really looked like, but this idea that a third of the land in some places was set aside. I mean, we have fences and walls everywhere. We don't set aside anything. Was set aside for the common good and for generosity. If that was going on in our world today, last night I had an amazing opportunity. I got to go to Montgomery, Alabama. And part of my story, in addition to being a pastor, is that for about 10 years I was immersed in the work of Dr. King. I worked at the King Papers Project at Stanford. I mean, I commuted out there. I lived in Cincinnati. I didn't get to live in Palo Alto. But I commuted out there and worked on a volume of Martin Luther King's early religious writings. And that led to a dissertation on the Montgomery experience and movement and how the community of Montgomery shaped Dr. King, and became a book called Becoming King that looks at that relationship. And I had this amazing opportunity last night to go to Alabama State University and their Center for Civil Rights Study and be on a panel and speak on the 60th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott started on December 5th of 1955. And so at this time, 60 years ago, Dr. King and Ralph David Abernathy, his good friend, on that Saturday night, were going out to the pool halls and the juke joints of Montgomery to tell people who wouldn't be in church on Sunday that they're not going to ride the buses on Monday. And the whole boycott itself was such an example of economic action. And in a sense, a radical claim of an economics of compassion. But it was not in a vacuum.
Is it okay? Should I just wait for a second? Yeah, okay. All right.
There are no accidents.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so Montgomery at that point in time in the early 50s was a place of isolation and fear. And the violence that we see in the world today was a threat of violence that hung over particularly African Americans in Montgomery and throughout the South and really throughout much of America. And some would say, and many of us might say, that that same reality is even here in 2015, far, far too often. But that fear was there, the threat was there, and also the whole specter of an economy that was totally rooted in debt and never getting ahead. After the Civil War, this whole idea of sharecropping and debt peonage, where the basic system was, well, we won't literally enslave you, but we will own you because you will owe us money in perpetuity, and that debt will get larger every year. That's what life was like for many freed slaves. It's why many eventually, it's one of the reasons, in addition to lynching and a bunch of other crazy, insane, dehumanizing stuff that was going on in the South, that the Great Migration happened. But it was an economic system that bound African Americans, intentionally bound them through debt peonage and through sharecropping. And that system was still very much a part of the economic vulnerability of most African Americans in and around Montgomery in 1955 was overwhelming. There was a guy named Vernon Johns, who was the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church before Dr. King. And Vernon Johns was a brilliant, amazing preacher. The word is he knew every single verse of the Bible by memory, could memorize and quote whole poems from Shakespeare and others. He was a brilliant man. He also believed that for real freedom, there needed to be a different economics at the heart of the African-American community. So he would, while being a preacher, sell eggs. And actually, to the chagrin of his learned church in Dexter, sell watermelons, sometimes even on the campus of Alabama State, embarrassing his parishioners. But his point was to agitate the enlightened, educated African Americans that there needed to be an investment in an economic plan that divested of independence on white culture and white economics, which was very much tied to a system that was responsible for their dependence and debt and vulnerability. In fact, Vernon Johns started something called Farm and City Enterprises in the 50s, which was a co-op run by owned vegetables, produce, fruit, for the African American community. He was innovating about what does it mean to build a different kind of community. And after a few run-ins, he was actually dismissed from Dexter, partly because he had embarrassed the faculty at Alamo State a few times too many. But when the boycott happened, I believe that was a year of jubilee in many ways for the African American, frankly, for the entire community of Montgomery, Alabama, and whether they knew it or not, it was a year of jubilee, a year of becoming unfettered from a dehumanizing system, of saying no, with they were no longer going to spend their money at a bus company that didn't view them as fully human. And it was owned, by the way, by corporate interests that were not from the South. It was a national organization or company that owned that bus company in Montgomery. They were going to withdraw their support, even if it was a nickel at a time. Not one more nickel or not one more dime. And guess what? Those resources went somewhere else. And it went through makeshift, at first a makeshift African-American-led system of cabs and cars that drove people around, sometimes for free, sometimes for pay. They bought, they purchased with resources that came in, a whole fleet of station wagons for every congregation, and they would transport people. One of the stories from the bus boycott that the mayor's his nickname was Tacky. I don't know if I would like my nickname being Tacky, but Tacky Gale didn't apparently mind too much. He was the mayor of Montgomery at the time. He said at one point, you know, this bus boycott would be over if the white women would stop picking up their domestic workers who did the work in their houses. And Virginia Durr, who was a real champion, a white woman and champion of civil rights movement, said, well, my friends would say, well, if Mayor Gale wants to come home and come to our homes and do the laundry and get the kids ready, and then we'll be glad to stop. Basically, they were part of the reason the boycott worked. Is they engaged in economics of compassion and actually got up and drove in. They would make up stories for why they did it. You know, well, I was just happened to be on that side of town, but they were committed to creating a new fabric of relationship. And, you know, we could go into, there were all sorts of problems with the domestic worker situation in general. But there was at least a different kind of spirit that took over. And partly what happened was the people who boycotted those buses, guess where also they didn't spend very much money? In Montgomery Fair Department Store. And in all the downtown white-owned businesses. Because it was harder to get there. And if they were walking both ways, and they didn't have automobiles, and frankly, if they were under threat of violence and being harassed, they didn't feel much like going to Montgomery Fair and purchasing things for the holidays or buying an Easter dress for the family. They made the decision to make their own clothes, to purchase locally. The dollar turned over so much many more times during that year in the African-American community. It's hard to even fathom. One of the things that I often point out is that there were originally three demands of the bus boycott, which were drawn up, you know, 60 years ago. And I always ask, does anybody know what those three demands were? Someone will let you participate for a second. What were the three original demands that Ralph Abernathy and E.D. Nixon and Martin Luther King came up with and a few others 60 years ago, almost on this very day? Does anybody know? It's not a particularly trick question, but...
Well, I don't know, but I could guess that it would have something to do with letting blacks sit in the front row.
Okay, let blacks sit in the front row. If they got on and started, and so one of them was first African Americans start in the back and move front, whites get on and start in the front and move back. But once you have your seat, you cannot lose your seat, and there's no dedicated seats for whites, which is what was happening. So in theory, with that plan, if it was an all-African-American route, they could, in fact, sit in the front seat. But it wasn't explicitly that demand. That was the second demand. The first was courteous treatment of patrons. So those first two things were not heavy lifts. In fact, most of they both, you would think. The third one was the one that E.D. Nixon, who was a Pullman car porter, demanded be part of those demands. And that was that they hire African-American bus drivers for predominantly black routes. So the first two, ended up getting reshaped through a national, through a federal lawsuit and a Supreme Court ruling, right? Which was not an original demand for desegregation. It ended up happening. But the third one, does anybody want to guess when Montgomery hired their first African-American bus driver?
2013.
You are really pessimistic. 1964. So basically a full 7+ years after the end of the boycott, that original demand still had not been met. And part of the critique of E.D. Nixon as the boycott wore on was that their attention to the economic opportunity before them was not what it should have been. And after the boycott was won, not only did the violence ramp up to an unbelievable degree, the Abernathy home was bombed, the Gretz home was bombed, they were both clergy, First Baptist Church, Abernathy's church was bombed, there were gunfire, there were bullets flying through the buses the first few days that they were integrating. They were actually shut down. So the buses get integrated, 2 weeks later they don't even run. Because of the violence and because of terrorism is what it is. We don't talk about terrorism a lot, but I'm amused. I'll make hopefully this is a partisan comment, but an amusing comment about, basically today Ted Cruz said that Christians have not been participants in terrorism for hundreds of years. There was, not only did that happen, but what the movement did in Montgomery at that point was shift to moving for more integration of things like parks, the airport, because frankly, people who were caught in debt in 1950s and struggling to get by and walking to work as day laborers and domestics, what they really needed was an integrated airport. That's what the fight became. And not that those are not worthy goals, don't get me wrong, but what was missing was E.D. Nixon calling for a credit union, an African-American owned credit union in that city. What was missing at that point, and frankly what was missing from the civil rights movement that was latent in Montgomery, but was missing as a core strategy until at least 1966, was a strong economic analysis about an alternative economy that could be built. Now, I will say that Malcolm and others were exploring around the idea of what does it mean to create an alternative sense of community and not try to engage the macro culture. So you had that kind of debate going on. And so there were those spaces where that was happening. But in the traditionally understood civil rights movement, a moment was lost there. What I think was beautiful about that boycott is it wove together a very real fight for the full humanity to be recognized in the public arena, in the public square. It was a fight for justice. It was advocacy. It was organizing. It was strategic. It was mass meetings twice a week and then once a week. It was real public protest, which is what Amos is striving to be and become more like the Montgomery Improvement Association, married with an incredible economic plan that had potential to keep going after the boycott ended. And I liked what you said about Jubilee isn't enough. They had their year of Jubilee, but they missed the opportunity that was created out of that Jubilee to create an alternative economy. And so what I am hopeful, and I've seen the document others of you have probably worked on and been a part of, what does economics of compassion look like as we move towards 2019 and beyond? It could be a mix of the best of what was experienced in 1956 in Montgomery, Alabama, that goes on year after year and builds a new alternate economy that is building great co-ops and is creating local food and is creating local jobs and is creating local wealth and is creating alternative even ways of paying and imagining how we get around and how we live together. And by the way, that's the thing. Last night I was there in Montgomery and I was surrounded. There was a guy I met named Dr. Bryson. And I see him, and I realized I had written and read about him after I met him. But I first noticed an Ohio State thing he had on. He's in his 80s. He said, yeah, I have 2 degrees from the University of Cincinnati. And we were talking about stuff here from the, like 1940s, I think, right around in this neighborhood. But he was a professor at Alabama State and attended Dexter. But these were folks who were part of the boycott. And one thing that is there, and you see this with people who have been in struggle together, the community that they built, the relationships of people that are now, many of them, 70s, 80s, even 90-year-old that are in that room last night that I had a pleasure to be part of, is transformative. It's not isolation, folks. It's not isolation. That's what's possible. And what I'm excited about with what's emerging out of the economics of compassion is that Amos can be a partner in this. We do some things that, you know, we're fighting for 2 years of quality preschool for every child. And we believe that's a way to do something radically different in our community, something no one else is doing. A massive investment of $250 million over 10 years in children. And we're fighting that we do it right with respecting every child and racial equity. And we're fighting for only good jobs and to keep family voices at the center, all which we think are moving beyond isolation and making sure those that are most vulnerable are actually benefiting from this program. We're also fighting the juvenile justice system. We have a juvenile justice task force. I went to court, or I was down there for a Leadership Cincinnati thing a few weeks ago. And I actually watched the bond hearings. Has anybody ever seen the bond hearings? Go down to the courthouse any morning at about 8:30. It is one of the most dehumanizing things I've ever seen. And it's about the very topic we're looking at, which is lining up a bunch of people who have been accused of a crime. And they are running there, most of them with public defenders. They do like one a minute. Is that not right? It's about one a minute. And they are given bails or bonds of $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $50,000. Many of them for nonviolent offenses, a possession or charges like that or some sort of... And what that does, by the way, is it puts that person who's been accused in a bind where if they want to get out and they can't afford their bail, which a lot of these folks can't, and we've been through a little bit, see Brian there, this summer just after a protest, there were bails of $80,000 after a protest this summer. What it does is it encourages people to take a plea, no matter whether they're guilty or not, because that's the only way to get out. And you take that plea and you take all that goes with it, which is a lifetime debt of being a returning citizen or someone with a felony conviction on your record. It's all interrelated. We have to fight that stuff. And
We need the co-ops like what's emerging in Clifton and Apple Street Market and the amazing things that are emerging in this community that are the dreaming about possibly a credit union. This is some of the stuff that I'm seeing here. A micro enterprise loan fund is part of the vision for this group moving towards 2019. A debt release plan. What would it look like? And actually having the resources and the capacity to handle debt a lot different than that bank responded to me in my life a few years ago. Continuing to do research and education. These kind of forums need to continue, hopefully, in 2015, these conversations. Advocacy around a host of things, including a living wage and making sure that we're attacking debt slavery and debt peonage. I just saw the documentary two nights ago, Slavery by Another Name. How many of you have seen that? That would be worth. Have you seen that? It's a look at the debt peonage system after slavery. And it is a documentary that came out by PBS a couple years ago, about 90 minutes long, that I think would be worth incorporating or maybe doing something together. Amos would be glad to co-sponsor something. But that we have to look at how that still lives today. And then what does it mean to truly live it? You mentioned that we have to start with ourselves. How do we live into an alternate economy? So I'm just thrilled to be part of this. I'm deeply saddened that other commitments have kept me away from these until tonight. I'm excited, though, and I think Peter knows this and others that are part of the team, that really am excited to be considered at least a partner in this and hopefully a co-conspirator of something amazing that we can do together. What does it say right now on the top of this? The time is now, Cincinnati, the place. So let's make that happen. Thank you.